Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All the market volatility the past week or so, the wild gyrations and the ups and the downs, it is all totally normal. Trust me. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 10th of October. Great, as always, to have you with us. I promise, I am Kai Rizdahl. All right, listen, to absolutely nobody's surprise, the week ended badly on Wall Street. All three major indices headed south today, most of the other indexes as well. But there was one number that finished on the upside today, up 13%, to be specific. Something called the VIX, the Volatility Index. Just like it sounds, it's a measure of how volatile people think the S&P 500 is going to be in the short to medium term. Suffice it to say, right now, people think the market writ large is going to be plenty volatile. From our New York bureau, Sally Herships gets us going.
There are some parts of the stock market you don't need to be an analyst to understand.
Markets, I don't care what market it is, they just don't go up in a straight line.
Scott Wren is a senior equity strategist with Wells Fargo Advisors. He says it's in the nature of markets to give investors a bumpy ride, but this recent ride has been more bumpy than most. Investors have a lot of reasons to be worried. Bad news from Germany, Ebola.
What's the Federal Reserve going to do with interest rates? How much is China going to slow?
You know what? It's like a GPS system. Calculate, recalculate, recalculate yet again.
Quincy Crosby is a financial market strategist at Prudential. She says investors are recalculating this time because of the Federal Reserve's plan to stop buying bonds. But she says we might see another recalculation when we get more company earnings next week.
Are they seeing demand for their products? Are they seeing demand picking up?
Some good numbers could mean the market will come roaring back or not. Placing a bet either way is risky.
Remember, this isn't a science. A lot of people think it's a science. It's as much an art form as it is a science.
If you look at the stock market and you try to figure out what's driving it, it usually is some combination of fear and greed.
Wren is feeling optimistic, and he's willing to put money on it. His bet is the market will come back. He says it's only 4% off from its all-time high. But he admits the stock market is a gamble. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
This being a Friday, we are going to do what we do every Friday right about this time of day. Spend four, maybe, I don't know, five completely unscripted minutes figuring out what the heck happened the past 5 days. Here to do that with us are Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, also Neela Richardson from Redfin. They are in our studios in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right. So, Neela, give me the long-term view on volatility. Should we worry about it, like, substantively?
No. Long-term volatility doesn't mean a hill of beans.
All
as
right.
long as stock markets go up every year, there's going to be hills and valleys. But over the long term, we expect for the stock market to be a very good bet for investors.
Sudeep, does volatility, though, beget more volatility? If people are nervous, do I not then get nervous and add to the volatility and it all just kind of goes nutso for a short period of time?
It certainly can go nutso for a short period of time.
that's
one reason to worry about volatility in the short run, because if it feeds on itself, it can get confusing. And both not just traders, but businesses and some regular investors can be moved by markets. Their confidence can rise up and down. Blood pressure moves for all sorts of reasons. And that's one thing that can weigh on the economy. It's not necessarily a huge thing, but if we end up having wild swings, then that's one reason to worry.
Well, so talk to me for a second about regular consumers and confidence, Sudeep, because the IMF came out this week, and you've been running around these meetings down there in Washington. The IMF basically said this week the American economy is the strong thing in the global economy, that China's weak and Europe is weak, and if good things are going to happen, it's going to be because of us. That's a little daunting, don't you think?
It's a little daunting. It's a little scary because we probably don't have the capacity to hold up all of these other economies
right.
at the same time. And it kind of feels like we're back in 2011, where we used to refer to the U.S. as the cleanest dirty shirt. Our shirt has actually gotten a little cleaner and others have gotten dirtier. And that's a big problem because there's only so much we can do to hold up an economy where China is slowing, where Europe may be headed into yet another recession, and Japan looks like it already is in another recession.
Well, then, Neela, what are we supposed to do?
Well, you know, our exports need a partner.
Yeah.
And so we need that demand to go someplace. We need a place to go in terms of trade. And if our biggest partners, Europe and Asia, are on the slump, we're actually not going to be a bright spot for very long. And so it all goes back to creating that demand at home and trying to invest abroad. And so when you see all this volatility, it actually restricts the U.S. from doing what the world needs the U.S. to do, which is to invest at home and abroad.
You know, but Neela, so the Fed minutes from its last meeting came out this week. The Fed urges patience, right? They pointed to in the minutes of this meeting, they didn't say it at the time, but in the minutes of the meeting, you know, it talks about the strong dollar. It talks about Europe and China slowing down. What is Janet Yellen thinking right now as we all know, she starts getting ready to think about, you know, in 6 or 8 months, raising interest rates?
Right. Well, first of all, Janet Yellen's really happy that we had a strong jobs report last month,
yeah,
I think. And secondly, I think she is thinking about, you know, when the Fed looks at their interest rate policy, it's really domestic focused. But now we have to figure out how QE and the retraction of QE is going to affect the rest of the world. We know that a strong dollar has effects, and we know that QE has manipulated that dollar for a really long time. And so the global effects are finally going to have to start weighing in on the concerns of the Fed. You're going to see that, I think, in the minutes.
But Sudeep, doesn't she have enough to worry about?
She does have enough to worry about here because we haven't had that vigorous of a recovery, even though we've come a long way. And that's why all of this, all of these concerns from the IMF matter so much, is because they've been making the same warning after warning, year after year, about all these other economies. They were doing it in an environment where the Fed was really stepping on the gas and was trying to do a lot more than it's going to be doing over the coming year. And that's why this time looks a little bit different. We're seeing the limits now of the central bank superheroes. They're not going to be here to rescue us this time like they were before. And that's a little worrying for markets that have been riding on central bank actions for the last 5 years.
Yeah. And just to be clear and really quickly, Sudeep, because we're past out of time, but this now makes the interest rate decision all the more freighted, right? With us the strongest and the rest of the world weak, this is now a much bigger deal.
Absolutely, because what happens if this interest rate decision starts to slow the U.S.?
Right.
Then we're really in a lot of trouble.
All right. Neela Richardson from Redfin and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
All right, have a good weekend. We'll talk to you soon. On Wall Street, as you know, lousy week, lousy day. Details, numbers, when we get there. The number of the day today in commodities was $83.59. That's oil. The price was its trading lows during the session today in New York, closed just a tad higher. But the point is this. We are getting real, real close to something of a tipping point where a lot of the oil that we have been pumping here in this country is getting less and less profitable. Marketplace's David Weinberg explains what happens when that happens.
In much of North America, oil comes from shale, which has to be fracked. Water and chemicals are pumped into the well to create pressure that forces oil out of the ground. It's a lot like squeezing a sponge, says Robert McNally, president of the Rapidan Group. At first, a lot of liquid comes out.
You get a rush up front. Your initial production rates are very, very high compared to conventional oil.
But after that initial squeeze, output declines sharply.
So in order to keep the overall flow, you're having to drill. And drill and drill.
All that drilling is expensive. This is how shale oil got the nickname tough oil. If the price of oil continues to drop, it's currently at $86 a barrel, it could make tough oil too expensive to drill for.
I think you could pretty easily put out a number of, say, you know, $75 a barrel, where, you know, that's kind of your break even when you include all of your development, production costs, et cetera, that go into that.
Chad Mabry is an analyst at MLV and Company. He says some regions in North Dakota and Texas, the sweet spots, he calls them, would likely remain profitable even if prices continue to drop.
I think one of the first places that you're going to see budget cuts are going to be more on the exploration side of things.
The demand for new wells would likely drop significantly if prices stay low, but that is largely dependent on outside forces.
It always comes down to what Saudi Arabia's decision is And that's going to be the real driver on where prices go.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Monday, for the calendar aware among us, is Columbus Day. In honor thereof, government offices, a lot of schools, and a lot of banks are going to be shut down. Ditto for Memorial Day, President's Day, and Martin Luther King Day, to name just a couple. Mighty convenient they all come on Mondays, huh? Nice to have regularly scheduled three-day weekends and all. For that, we can thank Congress and some other folks, too, as Gigi Duban explains.
If Columbus Day for you is a time to stock up on towels, or better yet, get out of town, you're in good company, and you're doing exactly what Congress wanted you to do back in 1968 when it passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act. Spend money. Gerald Friedman teaches economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Well, there was very strong support in Congress, but the initiative came from the tourism and vacation interests.
Like the hotel industry lobby and the American Automobile Association, he says. You could see why hotels that would normally be dead on a Sunday night would be all about this.
And it was very consciously decided that we wanted to promote vacations and leisure, and people felt a three-day holiday would lead to more traveling.
And it has. During a typical three-day weekend, AAA estimates more than 34 million Americans hit the road. And even if people don't leave town, there's always the mall. John McNamara is Senior Education Fellow at the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History.
So we have things like Veterans Day sales. We have Columbus Day sales. We have Memorial Day sales.
The National Retail Federation doesn't track sales over Monday holidays, but they're big shopping days. McNamara says, here's the sad thing. People have forgotten why they have the day off. That's one reason Veterans Day was shifted back from a Monday holiday to its traditional November 11th. So if this stuff isn't set in stone, maybe more three-day weekends are in store?
I'm kind of waiting for them to move 4th of July to a Monday.
I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
The home ownership rate in this country is well below where it used to be. There are more renters and fewer buyers out there. That makes sense, given the collapse of the U.S. housing market 6 or so years ago. But that does not mean that nobody is buying. In fact, the past couple of years, it's been open season for investors who want to be landlords. And I'm not just talking about your cousin who used to be a broker here, you guys. It's big money out there, private equity firms and hedge funds. Stan Alcorn breaks it down.
For 25 years, Kathy Cobb has lived in Cincinnati's East Price Hill on a block packed with wooden frame houses and miniature lawns.
We all went to the same church. The kids would play outside, and it was more of a neighborhood.
This area was decimated by the housing crisis. On a nearby block, nearly one in two houses fell into foreclosure.
I don't think anybody's in that one. And there's nobody in that one, so we're the only ones left.
The only homeowners left on the street. Neighboring houses became foreclosures and vacancies, and then, in the last few years, they became occupied by renters, who Cobb doesn't care for.
The new people just come in, tear things up for a year, maybe 6 months, and then go away.
Nationwide, millions of households have gone from owning to renting, and that shift toward what's been called a rentership society caught the attention of institutional investors, hedge funds, real estate investment trusts, and private equity firms like Blackstone.
The way the institutional investors think of this is, what is the most attractive investment I can put in my portfolio?
Lori Goodman is the director of the Housing Finance Policy Center at the Urban Institute.
And when home prices fell to very distressed levels, they were able to buy up properties, rehab them, and rent them out and achieve a very attractive return on their investment.
They were basically making a bet on the gap between record low prices to buy a house and a stable, growing market to rent one. Since 2012, that bet has grown to tens of billions of dollars.
They've sort of standardized the operation. So everyone gets gray carpet number 53. Everyone gets this type of refrigerator, this type of toilet, this type of oven.
These new industrial-scale property managers now own nearly 200,000 homes.
It's important, though, to not lose sight of the fact that this is a very small proportion of the rental stock.
Institutional investors own fewer than 5% of the houses converted into rentals since the crisis. They're actually just riding a much larger wave of investors trying out the same basic idea, but on a much smaller scale. In Cincinnati's East Price Hill, Ken Smith runs a community development corporation, revitalizing the neighborhood by fixing up neglected homes, like a stately yellow two-story on Beach Avenue.
The street has a lot of potential and has a lot of investment.
But two blocks down, the home buyer is a California company called Raineth, which has scooped up more than 100 houses in the area.
It is certainly empty with the number, looks like on a Sharpie, written on the front of the house.
Like several other Raineth-owned properties we visit, there's garbage, peeling paint, and an overgrown lawn. Smith's worry is that this won't change.
We want others to invest in the neighborhood, bring capital to the community to help rebuild it. But we know there's good investment and there's bad investment.
He worries that an investment seeking high returns from rent rather than the home's value will mean an incentive to cut corners on long-term repairs to the detriment of the community.
Let's face it, you could put $70,000 into a home and get a certain amount of rent, or you could put $30,000 into that home and get maybe less rent, but a better return on the $30,000 investment.
I can understand people's concerns, but from my perspective, they don't really make sense.
Ed Renick is the founder of Raineth.
So what they're worried is that we're going to bring $50 million into these communities and then not care about the long-term value of the assets we bought with $50 million.
The 12% annual return Raineth is promising its investors is based on rental income, not the home's long-term value. But Renick points out the alternative isn't a more selfless or far-sighted buyer. It's no buyer at all.
We are taking houses that are empty. We are taking houses that are broken.
And the $6,000 to $8,000 Raineth spends on rehabbing each home, compare that to what local landlords might spend.
Those local landlords are great people, but they're also significantly cash-constrained. And a cash-constrained landlord is a bad landlord.
Cincinnati will find out soon whether an investor-constrained landlord is better. Raineth aims to buy 25 houses a month here. And a $3.5 billion business called American Homes for Rent has bought more than 1,000. It was just named the fastest-growing housing company in the country, with revenue growth last year of 3,000%. In Cincinnati, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Coming up.
By the late 1990s, the idea we were wasting our money on Starbucks was common discourse.
A mocha frappe blast from the past. That's what that was, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. Down day at the end of a down week on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 115 points today, more than 2/3%, 16,544 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 102 points, 2.33%, 4276. The S&P 500 down 22 points, more than 1.1%, ended things at 1906. For the week, the Dow off 2.7%. The NASDAQ dropped 4.5%, 4.5% is another way to say that. The S&P 500 lost 3.1%. Today, it was the tech sector that took the hit. Shares in Intel off 5%. Shares in NXP Semiconductors tumbled 12%. Microchip Technology also traded down 12% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, get this, I didn't see this earlier, down to 2.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. It's the second Monday in October, which means it's Columbus Day, a federal holiday. Still got to go to work? Well, you can look forward to lighter traffic. Nobel season wraps up with the final prize announcement, Economic Sciences. And Edward Albee's play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, open on Broadway October 13, 1962. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Robots. They can help build cars. They can vacuum your floor. They can do all manner of things. But You, that is, we people, have to know how to use them first. We have to learn how to program them. Where do you go to learn things? Well, you go to school, of course, or you go to your local library. Mark Herz took a swing by the public library in Westport, Connecticut.
Nah, you can't check them out. Sorry. But Nancy and Vincent are available for in-house use, and they can do some pretty cool stuff. They've got 24 points of movement. Knees, hips, elbows, shoulders, ankles, necks, you name it. They've got cameras and microphones in their heads. They walk, they talk, they do Tai Chi.
So they're totally in sync. They're playing their own music. Wow, balancing on one foot, leaning way over. Really smooth and graceful.
And they gesture a lot when they talk. Here's Vincent.
I use my hands above all to express my emotions.
Okay, so they're really cool and engaging toys with kind of Buzz Lightyear-ish bodies standing 2 feet tall. And even though they sound intelligent and responsive, they really only can respond to and do stuff that someone programs them to do. And that's why they're here.
There's an 8 to 80-year-old approach to things.
That's Alex Giannini. He's the manager of digital experience at Westport Library.
Where anyone at any age, at any level, can come in and learn how to program these guys.
Giannini says patrons will be able to use the coding language Python and have the robots do all kinds of things, like read stories to kids, dance, do a sales pitch, or...
We're thinking about doing robot poetry slams. Because they gesticulate like we do.
Maxine Blyweiss is the library director. She says good libraries have always been on the cutting edge. Blyweiss says in the 80s, libraries were the place where most people put their hands on a computer for the first time.
Fast forward 3 years ago, we put 3D printers in our library. So with robotics. We believe robotics is the next disruptive technology that people need to know about.
Well, if you fast forward enough, could robots disrupt the need for a librarian? Blyweiss says no.
Librarian as curator of information has never been needed as much as it is now because there's so much information out there.
Yeah, you want to keep those librarians on the cutting edge and keep them curating because information overload, right?
Vincent?
But everybody is a little crazy.
In Westport, Connecticut, I'm Mark Herz for Marketplace.
There is, in the historical annals of the personal finance industry, a concept known as the latte factor. It goes like this. Give up the grande, half-calf, soy, mocha, whatever. You take that money and invest it, and you'll have enough to retire on. It's an idea that first surfaced in Money magazine back in the mid-1990s. Commentator Helene Olin was writing a personal finance column for the Los Angeles Times back then, and she has this bit of history.
By the late 1990s, the idea we were wasting our money on Starbucks was common discourse.
She treated me to the Arabian mocha java.
And you misinterpret this how?
She's sticking it to me that she makes more money than me.
But that coffee was the cause of our financial woes only made the big time when it was highlighted by David Bach, a Bay Area financial advisor. He calculated that giving up a latte could net a woman up to $2 million. That's right, $2 million. Are you latteing away your future? Bach asked his readers. Bach came up with his $2 million by doubling the price of a latte to $5. Remember, this is 1999, and he assumed an 11% return on investment. Bach's return neglected to account for a little thing called inflation and another one called taxes. But the latte factor didn't hit the big time till 2004 when Oprah Winfrey discovered it.
If you like money, if you need money, if you'd like to have some money, this is a show for you. Take a look.
Within a month, the latte factor had gone viral. To be fair, Bach's Latte Factor was about all our small expenses, not just coffee. The Latte Factor sounded like common sense, but it didn't jive with the reality of how we lived our financial lives. We weren't spending more on luxuries, no matter what we thought. We were spending less. Instead, the cost of housing, healthcare, and education were all going up at rates well beyond our salaries and inflation. Think of it this way. At $5 per latte, I would need to give up 260 caffeinated drinks per month to pay my monthly health insurance bill. I think I need a coffee just to recover from that.
Helene Olin is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, oops. The good people at Nielsen, the television ratings company, said today they have discovered a glitch. Turns out that some of their ratings for the past 6 months or so have been wrong. People were counted as watching one network when they were, in fact, watching a different network. Looks like ABC was the big winner. Nielsen ratings are, of course, worth bazillions of dollars because that is what ad rates are based on. Quick note about us before we go. We are going to be in New York next week for a live stage show we are doing called How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers. It is Thursday, October the 16th in New York City. It's me, ballerina Misty Copeland, Hank Azaria, a whole lot more. Tickets at 92y.org. Check it out if you're in town. And with that, on this Friday today, the Dow gave back 115 points, more than 2/3 of 1%. The NASDAQ off 102 points, 2 1/3%. The S&P 500 down 22 points. That is 1 1/10%. Tad more, actually. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.